Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
I'm really looking forward to kicking into this next episode with Matt of Thrive Deeper. But just before we do, I've got some really exciting news for you. This is Stuart from the Thrive Deeper Network. Now, many people tune into a Thrive podcast every week. In fact, we are close to hitting 70,000 downloads from around the world since we started Thrive Deeper some 4 years ago. That's 70,000 downloads, or 70,000 people potentially, who have tuned in and listened to a Thrive Deeper podcast since we started. That's really exciting, and we're really encouraged by the feedback we receive on how these podcasts impact people's lives in very real ways. Now, our hope and desire is to continue to make the Thrive podcasts available for free. However, there are very real costs to make this happen. So, if you'd like to contribute to assist us in meeting some of these ongoing production and distribution costs, then we'd ask you to join our listener support program with a monthly subscription. Now, you can do this very quickly and simply. Here's how you do it. Just go to thrivetoday.tv. On your internet browser, thrivetoday.tv. At the top of the homepage, you'll see a button that says Donate. This will give you the option to support the Thrive podcast with a donation of $5 or $10 or $50 per month. You can set your own support level, whatever's achievable for you. So we hope you'll consider supporting this ministry in this way. To those who are monthly supporters, a really big thank you. Your contribution is helping us continue to provide the Thrive podcasts to people around the world for free. Now let's get on to this next episode of Thrive Deeper with Matt.
So you've got your... You've got your paper copies there.
Oh, I have.
Your paper copy Bible,
and I've got paper I have, this time too.
Well, I have got a sheet actually next to me with the kings of Israel and Judah on it, just to in these two columns, just to give me
folks,
a little bit of an overview.
It's not just a sheet; it's an A3.
I know A3, you know,
with .8 font. Or
that's
something
right. Like that. Yeah. So I worked out how to do the A3 thing on our printer. So you'll be happy to know. But otherwise, I've got my iPad, which. Good. Which I have Kings and Chronicles. Welcome to the guided tour the Book of Kings.
That's it. And we've got a big section in terms of what's happening to cover in this episode as we come out of 16 and lead into chapter 17. So why don't you give us a bit of a recap on where we've got to and the trajectory as we're seeing here for both Israel and Judah, and that would be great.
So we're thinking big picture here, and I really... We really want, I guess, that the goal here is to give our listeners a, as I said, really a guided tour, not in the details, but in the general framework of this book, to help you to understand what's going on and why these stories are here and why am I being told this and why am I being... The why is a very important question, Stu, because that's really where the meaning of the text is, because it's not just... These are not just
historical records.
Yeah, they are historical, but... this is actually a prophetic document. You know, this is it's got a very rich message in it. Mm. So it draws from official records. Mm. So it is, you know, underscore the fact that it is historical in terms of the information that it includes, but it's not historical in its intent. Yeah. Really,
I mean, this was written. Kings was written while they were in exile in Babylon. Whereas Chronicles was written after the return. So this is kind of like, how did we get here? Remember, let's remind ourselves. This is the writer's trying to kind of unpack how we got here in a sense, to try to find out how we get back.
Yeah. You know? It's worth actually pointing out, Stu, and again, it's a little bit of recap here, but the difference between Kings and Chronicles. Chronicles in the Jewish Bible, which has a different order of books to us. Chronicles is the last of the books in the Jewish Bible. So it's interesting, because the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and so forth are earlier in that, because they've got the law, the prophets and the writings, three divisions. Mm. And so the law is the five books of Moses, Genesis to Deuteronomy. Mm. And then the prophets, the books of the prophets, are everything from Joshua through, including Isaiah, Jeremiah, and, you know, so that's all referred to as the prophets, interesting, including Kings yes. is part of that division of books called the prophets. And then you've got the writings, which is the Psalms, is the bigger book. Mm. In fact, Jesus refers to, talks about the law, the prophets, and the Psalms.
Right.
Because that third division was often referred to after the biggest book, because the Psalms was the biggest book in that third division. So basically, Jesus is talking about those three divisions when he references that. I think the quote is something about everything that was done from the, you know, recorded in the law, the prophets and the Psalms, something like that. So you've got this last division, and it's interesting that Chronicles is the last of the books, basically because I think the reason is because Chronicles does a sweep, starts with Adam.
Yes.
And does this, it has all of these genealogies, which basically is basically a way of, by mentioning all these names in the genealogies, it's really a summary of the history. As the names are mentioned, you're meant to say, oh, yep, okay, this is a recap using the names on everything that's happened. And then it focuses on the kingship of David. Now, the chronicler is, the big issue for the chronicler is, what about the king? Is the coming king?
Yes.
Is seeding this hope for the coming king? And when is, you know, when is the, because they, in some senses, they still saw themselves in a kind of exile because they were still ruled over at the time when Chronicles was written by the Persian Empire. So the big question there is, when is the Lord going to return to his temple?
Yeah.
When is the Messiah going to come to establish God's kingdom? And
so recounting all of this actually sets the platform to say, see, God's been faithful in all these places.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not going to stop now.
You know,
we've just got to be patient.
That's right. So, and that's the point of focusing on David and the Davidic dynasty, because the Messiah that the chronicler is wanting to seed a sense of anticipation for, this Messiah is obviously a king in the line of David. So he wants to show the faithfulness of God to the line of David and to sort of seed that hope. So that's why the book of Chronicles is this last kind of book, because it summarizes the whole of the history of the Old Testament, and it really leaves things hanging in a way leaves this open question about the coming Messiah. So anyway, so far we've been looking at since the great kingdom of David and Solomon split in two, got the northern kingdom with now Samaria as its capital.
Yep. Known as Israel.
Known as Israel, that's right. Sometimes also just a reminder to our listeners, this is going to help you when you're reading through the Bible. Sometimes it's referred to as Joseph.
Right.
Because Joseph's the two sons of Joseph became two of the northern tribes, two of the bigger of the tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. Mm. So, and sometimes actually just referred to as Ephraim as well. It's funny how they, you know,
depends on all of these names. Telling the story,
It depends on who's telling the story. Yep. So that's the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom of Judah with Jerusalem as the capital. Mm. So now what the text shows us the flow in the northern kingdom is that despite whether the kings are bad or good, some of them are bad, some of them are good, God is faithful to his covenant with David. So there is always a king sitting on the throne. The Davidic dynasty is continued all the way through. Now, by contrast, and this is an important aspect of the story in Kings, by contrast, God had promised to Jeroboam that if he followed him, he would establish also his dynasty, but Jeroboam didn't.
Yep.
And so Jeroboam's son Nadab comes to the throne, but Nadab is assassinated by Baasha. So that line is cut off. In fact, Baasha actually kills off all Jeroboam's family.
Yes.
So that's in contrast to the fact that God is continually preserving David's line. But here is, you know, Jeroboam's line is cut short. Okay, so then Baasha rules. His son, Elah, comes to the throne. And the question is, okay, is this going to be, you know, is this now another dynasty? Well, no, because Elah is assassinated by Zimri.
2 years, I think, didn't
That's
he?
Right. And
Zimri even shorter, seven days,
and then Zimri is assassinated by, so Zimri assassinates Elah, and then Zimri himself is assassinated by Omri. Now, during the Omri's kingdom is a large and prosperous kingdom. The writer of Kings isn't interested in politics. He isn't interested. If we were dealing with history, we'd have heaps of information about Omri, because as we've said, Omri was even known of in Assyria. They referred to Israel as the house of Omri generations later. Omri, though, so he's a quite a prosperous king. Ahab, and we're going to pick things up from Ahab. Ahab is his son.
Yes.
So the question here is, is there going to be an Omri, you know, Omri dynasty? Ahab and is going to be the last of the Omri, Omriite kings. So
now Ahab has a 22-year reign, just to give a bit of historical context
here. Give us some summary.
And during that time, he expanded his father's, Omri's achievements, and Israel's influence. His military force was one to be reckoned with in the region. It was a time sort of 874 to 853 BC, I think it is, on increasing regional power, international prominence for Israel, economic prosperity for Israel. So in secular historical terms, they would probably speak of Ahab as being a fairly accomplished and highly considered king for the nation of Israel. But of course, as we are about to discover, the Bible has quite a different perspective the king of Ahab.
Look, Ahab, and so remember, we're dealing with the northern kingdom here.
Israel.
Omri had established the capital up in Samaria. So that's the Samaria, from which, you know, the Samaritans, the good Samaritans. It seems to, there's this rivalry between Israel and Judah and the Jews, Judah being the Jews. Pretty much from this time.
Right the way through.
And, you know, in Jesus' day, it hadn't got any better because, that's why Jesus can talk about the Samaritans in this way. Now, things historically changed a bit for the Samaritans, became a kind of hybrid when the northern kingdom was exiled. Some people stayed and the Assyrians sent Assyrians to live there. And so they were kind of a hybrid group of people. But that's another story. So, Ahab does all of the things that kings did in the ancient world and that seemed to be fine in other places, but this is not fine in God's sight. And he gives at least lip service to Yahweh, the God of Israel, but he is a Baal worshipper. Now, he marries Jezebel, and this is going to cause a lot of problems, of course, very famous problems. Interestingly, the origin of this relationship between Omri and the Phoenicians, so a part of, and I know we're talking about Ahab, but remember, Ahab married Jezebel. This was probably Omri's, you know, is engineering this for the sake
from
of this.
A trade alliance.
Exactly. Now, the alliance with the Phoenicians, with Tyre and Sidon up there on the northern coast, Phoenicia was directly north of the border of Israel in what is today Lebanon. So the Phoenicians were very important traders, big with shipping.
Yes.
These were the guys that if you wanted to be prosperous, you had to be... You had to have a relationship with these guys, right? Because these guys are going to take you, you know, are really going to help you with your trade. So Solomon made some big compromises really to get in, in with the Phoenicians. And we see now that this relationship right through this period, Israel becomes very dependent on this relationship with the Phoenicians, and so much so that when Jezebel comes down south, She's really a kind of co-ruler with Ahab. Ahab is meant to be the king, but because the Phoenicians are such an important alliance, she's going to have a lot of clout, and she's going to be using that as well. Now, she is a devoted Baal worshipper. And she's going to wipe out the prophets of Baal.
In fact, her father, Ethbaal, he was a king and a king priest. So he was like the Baal kind of guy in Sidon. And so you can imagine she's bringing that zeal into the state of Israel.
And so she wants to wipe, basically she wants to supplant the ancient faith of Israel and Judah with this Baal worship. So this is where, and this is the interesting thing here, Stu, this is where we get, we're introduced to Elijah.
Yeah.
And the stories of Elisha and Elijah that are now going to lead us right into 2 Kings play a really important part in this story. We've already seen a lot of prophets coming to this story. Now, remember, this is a prophetic narrative,
yes.
And so the role of the prophets is very important in this. And we should, as you read through this, you need to take note of that, because the prophets are really the voice of God to his people, and in particular the kings. Now, it's interesting to note here that in the darkest time, essentially, so we're told here that Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him, right? And you think, well, God's going to withdraw and just leave them to their own device. Well, actually, God doesn't stop speaking to them. In fact, the volume is turned up here. This is the very time in the midst of this darkness that you get this amazing ray of light in the persons of Elijah and Elisha, who come and do these amazing, amazing things.
Yeah, and just to remember, the state it got to was that Baal was now the official religion of Israel.
Yeah.
It was the state religion. Now.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not it was kind of there as well as it was the state religion.
That's right. And they're wanting to enforce. I mean, so you think, man, we've gone. I mean, Jeroboam's worship was bad enough. Now remember, Jeroboam's worship was. The golden calves were meant to depict Yahweh, so it was a kind of a twisted form of Yahweh worship, which because of the calves were also associated with Baal. It was really kind of smudging the boundaries there. Through this time, Baal worship is enforced.
And Jezebel, essentially, it's not like passive. She actually then goes out after all the prophets of the Lord.
Sure does.
And she wants to eradicate them. And in fact, we're going to hear about a person later, another prophet who hides 100 of them. We'll come to that later. But she's, it's not just we'll tolerate this. It's like we won't tolerate this.
Yeah.
And she goes hard after the prophets.
Now, the interesting thing here is that we meet Elijah. So Elijah declares to Ahab that there will be no rain in the next few years, except at my word. Now, this is really interesting because Baal, of course, was the god of the storms.
That's right.
It was Baal. This is why Baal worship was so important, particularly in that region of the world.
Fertility god.
In that region, they really depended on the seasonal rains. It's a very arid part of the world. And so Baal was the god who brought the rains. So Elijah declares to Ahab, as he has enforced Baal worship in the land, there's going to be no rain
until I say so.
Until I say so, as the mouthpiece of Yahweh.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting. What then happens is that he goes out into the wilderness. Now this should remind us, and we're going to get a comparison here, because in the midst of this drought, Elijah goes out into the wilderness, and we're reminded of Israel out in the wilderness, and he is fed
the same way.
He's fed in the wilderness. So you've got all these political machinations happening here, and all these things happening for the sake of political prosperity.
Yep.
But the Israel is going to flounder, during this time because of this drought,
which was 3 years. That's not like a 10-minute drought or a few months. This was three years. And Elijah was nowhere to be found, as you say. He was out in the wilderness. Meantime, Israel's going through this drought.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah. He's fed by ravens. He drinks from a brook there. Yeah. So God cares for Elijah, and it's remember, because it's not what happens to Elijah is also prophetic. Mm. So the prophets not only spoke the message, but they embodied the message.
Yeah.
So here he embodies a message of this is what it could be like, even in the midst of this, of the desert, it could be like, this is the sort of life God is saying to his people. This is the sort of life you could lead, but you've alienated yourselves from God. Mm. So then, Elijah goes from there, and there'd be no rain. He goes to a widow in Sidon. Now, this is up in the area of Phoenicia, right? Mm-hmm. Talking about the Phoenicians. So he goes up into that area.
Which is where Jezebel's father was the ruler.
Yeah, that's right. Father is the ruler up there.
Yep.
And Elijah goes there, and because God had directed him to a widow to supply her with food. Mm. And remember, this also is prophetic.
Yes.
So she is going to... she's going to express more faith, a seed of faith, but more faith than in Israel. And so she's going to have this remarkable relationship with Elijah the prophet and through Elijah with Yahweh. Mm. You know, this is the irony of this situation. You've got this Phoenician woman up in the north who's going to have this relationship and is going to be blessed by God, is going to be supplied by God. She's fed. She's given this, the miracle of the jug of oil, recall, where he says to her, the oil is going to keep flowing within this jug. And so she's able to sell it off. And then of course her son dies and he raises her son from the dead, right?
Yep.
This is remarkable. It's interesting.
That's the first recorded restoration of life in the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that particular time.
Yeah, there was I don't know if you remember the story of where is this? Matthew 15, the story of the Canaanite woman who I think it's in Luke's or Mark's account, we find out is a Syro-Phoenician woman.
Right.
And she's remember that time where this woman comes to Jesus and she says, "Will you heal my son?"
Yeah.
I think it's daughter. Her daughter had been taken ill.
Yes.
And Jesus ignores her, right? And so she goes after Jesus and the disciples say, you need to deal with this woman. He says to her, you know, I've come to the lost children of Israel, and she keeps after him and keeps after him. And then he says, it's not right to take the children's bread and give it to the dogs. She keeps crying out to him. You know, for Jesus, and this particular instance is an example of this amazing faith this woman has, who's not even an Israelite.
Yeah.
She's from Phoenicia.
Yeah.
And then she says, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall beneath the table. And Jesus is just, is delighted at her faith.
Mm.
Well, it's interesting. She's a Phoenician woman. Her daughter is healed because of this. So there's a real kind of harking back to this story.
Yeah.
When, in a sense, Jesus in that instance is trying to show up the lack of faith of his own people compared to this woman from this Phoenician woman who has faith and receives healing for her daughter. Well, here we have
Same thing happening.
Woman who receives healing for her son.
And Elijah was a complete stranger to her. Let's just go back when they. It's not like she knew of him, or he's a complete stranger who he comes and says, "You're going to look after me and feed me." And
that's right.
So it's phenomenal.
Meanwhile, of course, Elijah's being hunted down.
Of course.
I mean, he's being blamed on this. It's interesting. So there's some acknowledgement that that he's got something to do with this.
The troubler of Israel.
Yeah, the troubler of Israel, when actually, as Elijah points out, Ahab, excuse me, you're the troubler of Israel. Let's just be...
That's it.
So, they're searching for... everyone's looking for Elijah. They can't find him. Mm. I mean, God's, looking after him there. Ahab, it's interesting in 18 verse 7, Obadiah is one of these guys. He's a good guy.
Yep.
He's the one that sheltered all of these prophets.
He did.
And he's walking along. And it's interesting, it says Elijah met him. He's actually looking for a part of this crew that's looking for Elijah. But it actually, Elijah just turns up and meets him.
Yes.
And says, I'm going to go tell Ahab, we're going to have a little chat.
Mm.
And there's a bit of an interchange there.
Which was a bit of a challenge for Obadiah because he'd kind of been able to keep it a bit of a – he was the palace keeper, so he actually worked for Ahab.
That's right.
But he'd been
right,
able to keep this a bit of a secret, and suddenly now he's going to have to decide, do I declare my hand and what risk is there for me plus the 100 prophets I'm hiding?
So
a bit of a turning point for Obadiah.
It is, yeah. Mm. So this brings us to the famous meeting on Mount Carmel.
Yep.
Where Elijah calls Ahab and the people of Israel, gets them to bring all of the prophets of Baal, and we have this very famous contest. Mm. I have stood at the top of Mount Carmel. It's a lovely view from there over the land. Very fitting fitting place. It would have been the perfect place in those – that's exactly the sort of place where you would have had a high place. And so he calls on these 400 prophets.
Which kind of speaks to how big –
450 prophets of Baal.
How big Baal was as in terms of the religion if there's 450 prophets.
This is taking hold. He actually wants – he also wants the prophets of Asherah as well. Now, they don't end up turning up, but – we get these 450 prophets of Baal on top of Mount Carmel, and he has this challenge for them. We're going to each make a sacrifice on an altar here, and whichever God answers by fire, he is the true God. Mm. Baal was the god not only of the storms but of the lightning, and so there's some expectation that Baal really should be up for this.
Yep.
The prophets of Baal are, okay.
And in fact, Elijah probably particularly chose it for that reason. I mean, I think he was really trying to give the odds, stack the odds hugely against Yahweh so that when it did happen, there was absolutely no doubt here.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So this happened, and actually just on the prophets of Asherah as well. So they don't, I think the reason why he doesn't get them, because he tells Ahab, go get these prophets. So Ahab brings the prophets of Baal. Mm. The prophets of Asherah would have been more closely associated with Jezebel. Mm. So it shows, I think, the fact that he couldn't summon them, even though he's the king,
how much control
shows
she
actually had. How much control she has, because they don't turn up. Yes. So the prophets of Baal, they start their incantations and they're dancing around.
Well, before we get there, though, he kind of did ask the people, first of all, to choose before we went there.
That's
are you
true.
Going to make a choice?
Yeah.
And no one said anything because, obviously Baal was now, and they were probably happy with the fact that they could have Baal and Yahweh. But, of course, Yahweh is the one and only and won't be shared with anyone. And so they didn't really answer, did they? There's no record of the answering the question.
It actually says, but the people said nothing. When Elijah says, how long will you waver between two opinions?
Yeah.
People said nothing. They're probably scared.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remember, there's been purges during this time. Yep. So they're probably terrified.
Yeah. So then he moves on to the
sacrifice. That's right, yeah. And it's interesting what these prophets of Baal have to do, They call out to Baal and there's no answer. He gets to noon and Elijah begins to sort of taunt them.
Yep.
There's an element of humor, deliberate humor in this story.
Yep.
There's a couple of places actually where you really do get deliberate humor in the Old Testament stories here. And this is one of those places because he's taunting, shout louder, surely he is a god. Mm. Perhaps he is in deep thought or busy or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. In fact, on one translation, maybe you get the resting, maybe he is relieving himself.
Yeah, maybe he's in the bathroom.
Yeah, he could be in the bathroom. That's probably a more accurate translation there.
It is a bit of a taunt, for sure.
So it says, so they shouted louder and they slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Showed you the sort of thing this is. So this kind of ecstatic behavior is fairly common with these this frantic prophesying. It's pretty well attested in countries around the place, but there's absolutely no response. Elijah, then says, okay, they're all exhausted. At the end of the day, he builds this altar of uncut stones, he
12 of them.
12 of them, which stand for the tribes of Israel. and gets the, sets out the wood and the sacrifices, covers it with water, bring water, bring more water, more water, just to, you know, underscore yep. The impossibility of this. And then, of course, he prays this prayer and fire comes from heaven and, you know, even licks up the water and the sacrifice. Yep. And yep. So the people crying out, you know, the Lord hears God as you would, you know, in that moment.
And a pretty simple prayer, and it didn't have to go for hours.
No,
it was like a simple prayer, and God answered immediately.
Bang! Mm. Yeah. After all of this, it's interesting. The people turn back to God, and we have this, you know, the coming of the, you know, the return of the rains, yep. really, yep. And then. We have this very interesting thing that happens to Elijah.
Well, he orders Jezebel, all the Baal prophets get
yeah, they're all killed,
seized and killed. Yep.
So Jezebel, you can imagine, she's
furious.
Yeah, she's going to now step things up. So she sends, when she hears about this, she sends basically the death sentence on Elijah's head. I mean, it's really stepped up here, and Elijah's terrified. He runs for his life.
But the rain came. Hang on, the rain came before yeah. that, didn't it?
Yeah.
So now, you know, God provides the rain.
Yeah.
Because.
Yeah, that's right. Baal. Yeah.
Yep. But Elijah goes up and yeah. prays and yeah. asks for the rain to come.
Yeah, that's
now,
right.
And the rain
yeah.
comes, and so you know, in a sense, that's even more frustration for Jezebel because. This guy could get the rain, and yeah. for 3 years we haven't been able to. So
absolutely,
right.
yeah.
So he runs and hides. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yep. So he's, you know, he's really dejected. He goes into an interesting place here, Elijah. He travels
to Judah,
all the way down to southern. This is the southernmost town in Judah, Beersheba. It's down there in the desert. Mm. He dismisses his servant in Beersheba. Mm. And he goes a day's journey further. There's almost this sense that he is giving up. Mm. He's so dejected and down. You think after what has actually yeah, exactly. just happened.
Yeah.
But you can imagine how discouraging because she's she's stepped this up.
Yeah.
He has heard about other prophets being, but he's the only one really ministering. Everyone else is hiding. You can just imagine the whole the nation is now serving Baal. Mm. I mean, he's thinking, God, what are you doing here? This even that hasn't actually really
changed
helped
anything.
That much.
Yeah.
And it's interesting then that an angel of the Lord comes to him, tells him to get up, feeds him, gives him some drink. He travels 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Sinai, or Horeb, as it's called here, the mountain of God, and he spends a night in a cave there on Mount Sinai. So he goes. So this is a really significant moment.
Mm.
He goes all the way back 40 days and 40 nights. So it's the journey. Yeah, that's right. It's the journey of Israel in the desert in reverse,
yes.
right? And he goes back to Moses, to the time of Moses, and
so this is where Moses encountered the burning bush.
Yeah, this is where Moses...
Where the Ten Commandments was
that's
received,
right. yeah.
and also where he had experienced the glory of the greatness of God. Moses had
yeah.
experienced that. So it's a fairly significant place
yeah.
he's gone back to.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. It's interesting, though, that the word of the Lord comes to him
yeah.
and says, what are you doing here,
yeah, yeah.
Elijah? And he says, I've been zealous for the Lord Almighty, but the Israelites have rejected your covenant, and all of the prophets have been killed, and I'm the only one left, and they're trying to... Fair enough, like,
yes.
really.
Yep.
Imagine if there were, the whole of the church in this in Australia just completely decimated. There was there was no one left. One, and you're the last person.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you sort of heard of some people hiding away somewhere, but imagine how discouraging
absolutely.
That would actually be. This is the situation that he's in. And so the Lord says to, you know, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Now, this again, this is the same kind of thing that happened with Moses. Mm. Remember, the presence of the Lord passed, put him in the cleft of the rock, passed him by.
Mm.
So Elijah, so, the, you know, it's... It all with Moses. It all started with him meeting God. It's
yes.
one man meets God. history changes. Mm. So Elijah's taken back to this point. And but it's interesting here, you know, there's a great and powerful wind. You know, the Lord is not in the wind, great earthquake. Why is it, you know, the Lord is not in the, why is it saying, it's not that, I mean, God in a sense causes these things to happen, yeah. But this is speaking to Elijah's concern, right? Because Elijah wants, I want something, you got to do something big here, God, something big and sudden to change this. Like, why don't you just kill them and do some, you know, like what you did back in the time of Moses with Pharaoh, basically, like, why don't you do that kind of thing to Ahab, right? Mm. So God is answering that, okay? Yes. So he's looking for an answer from God. Okay, yep, I'll pass you by. Big storm, big earthquake, massive fire. No, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not doing that this time. Mm. And then there's this gentle whisper. Mm. And so Elijah goes out and the voice, and it's, and I think it's identified with this gentle, you know, gentle whisper. So I think...
We don't know what the whisper says though, do
no,
we?
No, well...
All we really know is that the whisper was the message itself. The fact that it was a whisper was the message.
Yeah. And it's, it's like a gentle, I mean, the idea of whisper and the gentle breath or the, you know, it's all, this is all kind of connected, and it's also connected with the prophetic word as well. So I think what the significance of this is that here, the most important thing now is not these big signs and wonders, but it's the word of the Lord. See, up to this point, God had done amazing things. You know, amazing acts of deliverance, and he'd established his kingdom, the great kingdom of David and Solomon. We got there. We've entered the land with all of these remarkable, you know, wonders. But now it's all about the word of the Lord. This is now there's going to be plenty of signs and wonders following this, but all of that is going to point to the fact that these are prophets of the Lord. So, so I think, you know, the gentle, it's like the Lord, okay, it's not about that. It's all about... it's all about the gentle whisper now, and the willingness to actually listen to what God is saying.
Which points a little bit forward to Jesus as well, when the disciples were looking for the revolution that was going to, you know, take by force the Roman Empire, and Jesus going, no, that's not that's not how
that's
we're going to do this.
Exactly, you know? That's what they wanted. They wanted the fire and the storm and the earthquakes, and they wanted all of that stuff. But Jesus is saying, no, the kingdom of God is going to be like a seed. And remember, the seed was the word in the parable. It's going to be like a seed that planted and it's going to give rise to a great kingdom. So it's all about, you know, it's this small, it's the small and the powerful small thing that's identified with the word of God that is going to change the situation, but not overnight.
No, that's right. Before we move on, I just want to go back to where God sort of says, Elijah, what are you doing here? I just wonder whether part of that is also he wanted Elijah to actually express how he was feeling, to actually say to God, this is where I'm at. And I think it's something we probably, you know, as Christians, we sometimes feel we can't go to God and say, I'm really feeling like I'm the only one here, or whatever it might be.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful conversation. Exactly. And Elijah has this
and God doesn't rebuke him for it.
No,
and God doesn't
right.
rebuke him for it. He just says, rest, here's some more sustenance, you know.
In fact, he goes through it twice.
Exactly right.
Because the voice says to him again, what are you doing here? And he brings it, brings this complaint again. And of course, the Psalms are full of, this could be a Psalm. It's full of, you know, complaints like this. And so, you know, the Lord tells him, go back to the desert, anoint Hazael king over Aram, which is interesting. It's like you are... I'm in charge of all the nations here, not just Israel, and also an anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, to succeed you as prophet. Mm. So he's, you know, Elijah's, there's still a number of things for Elijah to do yet, but this is succession. You know, so in a sense, God's playing the long game here. It's not just about you. You're just a link in this chain. Mm. And Elijah, we see... Elijah is a fallible character here, but one that is devoted to God, a very fallible character that is devoted to God, is used mightily by God. And here he is retired, and Elisha's going to, in a little while, is going to take his place.
Now, just on those two appointments that Elijah's told to make, neither of those guys are part of the royal family. So this is essentially, in both kingdoms, inciting revolution, really. It's quite... a dangerous thing he's been commanded.
Yes. So he's told to anoint Hazael king over Aram, Jehu king of Israel, right, in place of. So that's kind of the answer, because Jehu is going to be the instrument that's going to wipe out the family of Ahab, right?
Yeah.
So Jehu actually is the instrument of judgment. Now, Jehu's going to take that a bit far.
Yes.
This is kind of God's answer. Mm. I'm in charge of all of this. Mm. Anoint Jehu, and anoint your own successor. Yeah. So he does that. It's interesting. I'm going to skip forward a bit here because Ahab. God continues to speak to Ahab. He has some trouble with the Arameans come against Ahab. I'm skipping forward here. And it says, it talks, a prophet comes to Ahab. This is in verse 13 of 1 Kings 20. And says, you're going to be delivered, just so that you know that God can do this. Ahab's continually being shown that God will, if he only will turn back.
Yep.
This is the amazing thing about that story, because even at this point, even after all that's happened and the killing of all the prophets and the institution of Baal worship in Israel, God still is showing kindness to Ahab to constantly give him indications that if you will only turn back to me,
yes,
I will turn all of this around. You'll be forgiven.
Yep.
This can be turned around.
Yep.
And so that's the significance of that story where Ahab is enabled to defeat the Arameans. That's just to cut that story short. But that's the point of that.
And I think it happens again later where there's a rebuke and then he turns back and God says, well, because of this, it's not going to happen in your lifetime. I think that is.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's the point. And we're not going to go into those details, Stu, but there's quite a bit of space given to that story about how Ahab is enabled to have victory with God's help over the Arameans. You think it's in the midst of this story but then you get this story of the famous story about Naboth's vineyard, how Ahab sees this guy who has this vineyard adjoining his own property, says, sell me your vineyard. Naboth quite rightly says, this is the inheritance of my father. This is our ancestral property. There's no way we're going to do this. Jezebel, otherwise up in the north. She says, mate, just take it,
that's right.
You know.
Yeah.
So she organized for people to falsely accuse Naboth of blasphemy. Mm. False accuser. This is like the worst thing you can do under the law, under God's law, which puts such a high price on justice. He is falsely accused. He's stoned to death, Ahab, takes this vineyard. But then, verse 17, the word of the Lord comes to Elijah the Tishbite. Mm. Elijah comes back in here. He rebukes the king. He says, this is what the Lord says in the place, dogs licked up Naboth's blood.
Yep.
Dogs will lick up your blood. Yes, yours. Ahab comes back, aggressively.
Yes.
But he, as he hears this prophecy Elijah's, he has I don't know what happens here, Stu, but he freaks out a bit. There's Elijah also prophesies that Jezebel is going to be, because
that's correct, the same,
it's, the dogs are going to devour Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel, which happens, under Jehu. Mm. And it says down the bottom there, when Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and fasted. He lay in sackcloth and went around meekly. It says, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite. Have you noticed how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself, I will not bring this disaster in his day, but I will bring it on his house in the days of his son. That's talking about the destruction of the northern kingdom. Isn't it interesting that right here, in the midst of all that's happened, this moment of probably slightly half-hearted repentance on Ahab's part is enough for God to say, okay, I will respond. You know, yeah. if you will turn back, if you will show just the least bit of penitence before me and humble yourself before me, things can be turned around. And so it's this remarkable feature of the story that again and again you get these signs that even now if you turn back, God will save you. That would have been enormously important message for these exiles thinking, is God still with us? Is he, can we move ahead from here, given that all we've done? And the answer here is yes, you can. We can always turn back to God, no matter how far we stray. If we turn back to him, he will forgive us and restore us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.